where pork belly and pancakes popped and sizzled. The heat in the galley was hellish, and he was wearing only his orange dubiki, the loincloth rag he'd made out of one of his old pure-cloth saffron robes. It was covered in grease stains, and his arms were spattered with tiny dark scars from frying oil. He was so skinny it was hard to imagine he'd ever eaten before. As if to help me picture it, he grabbed a piece of bacon and tossed it, still sizzling, into his mouth.
"Just a pot, hm? Let's see."
He clanged through his collection, some hanging from hooks, some stacked haphazardly on shelves, some shoved in the corner behind the barrel of oil. He scooped a stack of coconut bowls out of a large cast-iron pot and handed it over. "This'll rust."
"You need it to hold water?"
He put the cast iron back on the shelf and ran his fingers down the row to a beaten copper kettle. "Salt water."
"Salt water? Just a pot, you say? You need glass."
He passed me a bowl. "Too small." His hands fell to his sides. Rotgut was usually quite patient, but there were limits. He'd left his monastery for a reason.
"What?"
he said, very deliberately.
"Do you need it for?"
Gently, using one hand, I lifted my shawl away from my neck, revealing the golden dragon sleeping on my shoulders. When I'd returned to the ship, I'd rushed to my room to raid my jewelry box. Swag had decided to help. He'd pushed his nose through the jewelry, snuffling and digging. I caught a glimpse of the long strand of pearls Kashmir had given me last year, likely stolen from a flapper or a society girl, before it began disappearing down Swag's throat. I tugged back, worried he'd swallowed the string, and the strand burst, scattering pearls across the floor. The little dragon rampaged through the room, claws clattering on the decking, chasing them down. Once he'd had his fill, he wobbled onto my shoulders, his stomach so distended it threw him off balance. He couldn't stay up there forever, though. Sea dragons needed water, and so I needed a pot.
"Look at this,"
Rotgut exclaimed, his eyes full of joy.
"You know, your mother had one like..."
"Exactly like this," I said. "I met Auntie Joss today." Some of the joy fell from his face.
"That old pusher. I'm surprised she isn't dead."
"She seems like a survivor to me."
"That's true. How did you find her?"
By merest chance, really," I said. "I was walking through Chinatown, and I noticed her sign."
"Really? Out in the open?"
"She's an apothecary now."
"Ah."
He leaned against the doorframe.
"Makes sense. Even the last time we were here, they were making it illegal to sell opium without an expensive license."
"Who was?" Rotgut shrugged.
"Probably people who wanted to keep the monopoly on opium."
I snorted, and Swag startled, then dropped his head back to my chest. Rotgut chucked the little beast under the chin.
"We had one, you know, in the river behind the temple. Bigger than this, of course, but only 3 claws, not 5. Why were you in Chinatown anyway?"
"Just looking around."
"Did you find what you were looking for?"
"You know, I could probably use a bucket." He found me a wooden pail with a brass handle. I'd be able to tie a rope to it and dip up fresh seawater whenever Swag needed it, which is what I did. Then I lugged the bucket to my room and eased the dragon off my neck and into the water. He barely batted an eye as he sank beneath the surface and curled up on the bottom, his nose almost directly under his fat belly. I'd never had a pet before. I'd seen ships with cats and dogs and parrots, and once an ancient tortoise, but we'd never kept animals on board, aside from the sky herring, or that aboriginal water toad. Ugh. With a little luck, I wouldn't accidentally kill Swag, although if he'd lived through 16 years of neglect after my mother's death, he had to be tough. Sitting there, gazing at the little creature, my eyes began to sting. I put the remaining pearls in a dish nearby, Then I ran back to the kitchen for another small bowl full of fresh water, just in case. I put it beside the pearls. Then, as nervous as a new mother, I moved both of the dishes closer to the bucket, then away a bit, in case he knocked into them getting out. As I was worrying over the arrangement, a voice drifted in.
"Halloo! Halloo the temptation!"
I listened, but no one else answered. Of course not. It was Slate's watch. I left off my fussing and headed topside.
"Halloo, the ship!"
I went to the rail and peered down. A man in his early 40s stood on the dock below me, dressed in slim-cut black trousers and a fine frock coat, all of it wool, and though the sun was still quite high, he didn't appear to notice the heat.
"Who are you?"
He squinted up at me, making a moue behind his dark, blonde, French-forked beard.
"Good day. I have a message for the captain of the ship."
I narrowed my eyes. He hadn't answered my question. "From who?"
"I represent a group of persons interested in arranging a business transaction,"
he said as easily as a lawyer. "And who are these persons?" I reiterated slowly.
"I am not at liberty to say,"
he responded as though he found that disappointing.
"May I come up and speak with him?"
B leaned over the rail beside me. I gave the man credit. He didn't so much as blink when he saw her.
"Go on,"
she said to me, putting her hand on the holster at her hip.
"Pardon?"
Her voice hadn't carried to the man's ears.
"I'm coming down,"
I shouted. I made my way down the gangplank and stood before him on the deck. He was a full head taller than I was. I had to shade my eyes as I looked up at him. Had the man purposely positioned himself so the sun would be over his shoulder? "I'm the captain's daughter. What can I do for you?" The curve of the man's smile was half a degree from condescending.
"A pleasure to meet you. When might the captain be available?"
"It's impossible to say," I said as sweetly as I could, "until I know what he is making himself available for."
"I see."
The smile was still there, but the mirth had gone.
"Then you may tell him I was sent by a mutual friend."
"The captain doesn't have any friends here."
"On the contrary, he has many friends. He has not yet met them all, but I am eager to make the introduction. I've heard so much about him."
His voice was deceptively light.
"Quite extraordinary, the stories of his exploits. Almost unbelievable."
The skin behind my ears prickled. What did he know? "Well," I said, trying to match his tone, "I wouldn't make a habit of believing every bit of gossip I heard."
"Oh, I don't."
He let his eyes rove over the temptation, the carved keel, the brazen figurehead. He nodded toward the mermaid.
"The things she must have seen, eh?"
I swallowed the sudden tightness in my throat. "If there's nothing more..."
"Just one thing. Please do tell him we will reward him generously for his help."
"We don't need money." I turned to leave.
"I'm not offering money."
I paused, with one foot on the gangplank, unwilling to ask. He told me anyway.
"We have in our possession a treasure map."
He steepled his fingers in front of his lips.
"And the treasure is one only your captain can claim, because he's the one who lost it back in 1868.
Damn everything. A mutual friend. I gritted my teeth. She'd said it even before I'd asked her for maps. A tall stranger and a long journey. But this was not Adelphi, and she was no oracle. It wasn't hard to see the future when you were the one planning it. She must have been ready for Slate's return, as patient as a spider on a web. But I was the one caught, unable to escape the threads of my past. Then I had an odd thought, a ray of hope. The map. Is the drafter's name Sutphen?
No, he said with a smile that was practically a twinkle. It is not.
I felt like Ulysses myself then, between Scylla and Charybdis, the beast and the abyss. I closed my eyes, struggling for composure. Come back tomorrow. The man took his leave, strolling merrily away, while I climbed the gangplank with heavy steps. B was shaking her head.
Never trust a man with a beard. They're always hiding something.
And not just his chin. He wouldn't tell me his name or his business. B rolled her shoulders.
Might be best if he never does.
I grimaced. He doesn't strike me as the type to give up easily.
I could take us out to sea, she offered. The gentleman won't be swimming in that suit.
And the next time we're in New York, the map will be waiting for us at Christie's for twice the price. I can't escape it, Bee. I started toward the captain's door.
Then fight it.
That doesn't work.
That's because you've been fighting with him.
She sighed, the air rasping in her throat.
You don't have to help him. You're not responsible. It isn't your fault your mother's gone.
My breath hitched in my throat, and she reached out with unusual tenderness and put her thumb on my chin. Then she clapped my shoulder.
But if you still want to escape, take the afternoon. Waking him up is not going to be pretty.
I bit my lip. I took leave this morning.
I won't tell on you.
B walked over to my hammock and kicked the lowermost curve.
Kashmir!
He flipped himself out of the sling and onto his feet, his eyes wide and his hair mussed.
What? Budge yourself and take this girl ashore. She's getting underfoot.
He blinked twice and then saluted.
Aye, Captain.
With little effort, he swept me up and hoisted me over his shoulder, knocking the air out of me.
"Shore leave,"
he shouted as he trotted down the gangplank. "Kashmir!"
"Ah,"
he said as I pounded him on the back.
"That was my kidney."
"Put me down," I said breathlessly, "or I'll take out the other one."
"You should know, Amira,"
he said, emphasizing the Persian accent he often kept hidden.
"We don't negotiate with terrorists."
I smacked his rear as he trotted ashore. On deck, B was shouting.
Ayan, pull back his blankets. Ratgat, start some broth. And get a bucket of cold water.
I thought again of Ulysses and of the sirens. Would B tie the captain to the mast until he was himself? Kashmir set me down on the dock and put his hands on the small of his back.
I know one of our options on leave is brawling, but usually that's later, after the drinking and the gambling.
I straightened my skirt, staring toward the ship, wanting to run back, wanting to run away. Do you think they'll be all right?
I have an idea, Kashmir said, pulling at my sleeve. Let's find you some new clothes.
You can't distract me with shopping, I said. I hate shopping.
And it shows. I'm not trying to distract you. I'm trying to help you.
I knew what he was doing, but I gave in anyway. I'm only helping you look good by comparison.
I don't need any help to look good. All you're doing is making it seem like I keep unfashionable company.
He jumped back before I could swat him. The street was much livelier than this morning. Wharf rats milled around the esplanade, ready to dive deep after a penny tossed into the ocean, and fishmongers were selling shellfish out of bushels on their backs. Riders cantered regularly down the dirt roads, men and women alike riding astride rather than side saddle, with long hair and garlands of flowers streaming behind them. Nearby were the distinctive sounds of a ukulele being played. I scanned the street and found the shop, wedged between a bar and a feed cellar. An old man was smiling and strumming,
while inside the shop, his sons bent their heads over their saws. This time, we turned away from Chinatown and toward fashionable downtown. Merchant Street was gravel to keep mud off lacy hems and shiny leather shoes. Discreet shingles offered the services of lawyers and bankers, factors and financiers, giving way on Fort Street to more ornate and fanciful signs advertising milliners and engravers, jewelers and dressmakers. Kashmir paused in front of a lovely shop with a bay window, shaded by a fragrant jasmine vine, and on the scent rode an incongruous memory of racing through the hot streets of Calcutta. He took a moment to finger-comb his hair and button his jacket. Even creased from long wear, it was still quite debonair.
"Let me do the talking," he said then. "I'm afraid if you make any decisions, you'll end up with a whiskey barrel and a pair of galoshes."
Then he breezed in through the door. Putting on airs in the most typically outrageous fashion, he ran his hands over every bit of lace in the shop, demanded tea in a perfect imitation of a posh English accent, and then announced, "I needed a new set of clothes immediately."
"We've just arrived from London, where she had an entirely new wardrobe made. And look, look how she grows. What is this, burlap?"
He rubbed a piece of cotton between his fingers.
"We need a finer weave. Her parents feed her too much. I swear, a girl at liberty to eat what she likes is at liberty to grow as tall as she likes. But do they listen to me? I am only the tutor, they say. They do not hire me to know anything. No, not Chinese silk. It's too inconsistent. Do you have any from Piedmont?"
The tutor was a persona he took on sometimes, often in the 18th and 19th centuries, whenever he and I were alone together in front of others. It was bossy, superior, and very entertaining. Kashmir picked words out of people's mouths as easily as he did the coins from their pockets. But I had no idea where he'd ever met such a supercilious personality. He was pulling out all the stops. He flounced onto a couch and shook back his curls as the two women hid their laughter behind their hands. The sign outside proclaimed them the Mercier sisters, fine dresses, and I learned their names were Nan and Emily. Measurements were taken, and much was made of how this lavender trim set off my eyes, or the green would complement my hair. Then, of course, Nan noticed my muddy sandals.
"Simple-minded girl,"
Kashmir said, shaking his head and tut-tutting.
"She had a lovely silk pair when we left California, but she was battling a touch of mal de mer, and an old salt convinced her the cure was to drink tea out of her right shoe."
Nan, the older sister, shook with laughter, but Emily's eyes were round.
"And what happened to the left?"
"We served biscuits in it, of course,"
Kashmir answered.
"Only the lowest sort has tea without biscuits. Can you make up a new pair to match?"
We left the shop with the promise of a dimity cotton skirt and an embroidered jacket, a white and pink striped silk dress with a modified bustle of some description, and a new pair of silk shoes, all to be ready next week. We also had a drastically lighter coin purse, although Kashmir had only put down a deposit, with the balance to be paid on delivery. Once we'd left the shop, I shook my head and whistled.
"Don't worry," Cash said. "Money is best spent quickly. You never know when someone might pick your pocket."
"I never knew you had such a fine eye for fabrics," I said as we continued up the street. "You should have been a tailor instead of a thief."
"I have a fine eye for all things, Amira, which is why I'm a thief and not a tailor."
I laughed in spite of myself. "I just hope I do those fine fabrics justice." He looked at me then, with one eyebrow up, and said something under his breath in what sounded like Persian. I didn't understand that.
"You weren't meant to."
His expression, a peculiar half-smile, embarrassed me. So I turned toward the shops on the other side of the street and pretended to be interested in the hats in a window. They were fantastically styled, with swooping brims and showy feathers.
"You don't want those," Kashmir said. "They've used albatross."
"Ugh, really?
To a landsman, they're very fashionable.
How did you learn so much about clothes anyway?
Necessity. Clothes have always told most of my lies for me.
Ah. We were both quiet for a moment, staring at the window. I could see his shadowy reflection outlined in the glass. This isn't what you usually do on shore leave. He shrugged one shoulder.
I can't deny it.
So what do you actually do for fun? A slow smile spread across his face.
I told you before.
Dens of iniquity?
Drinking, brawling, gambling.
Think carefully, Amir.
You may regret it.
I'm counting on it. Chapter 12. From the milliner's, I followed Cash to Fidd Street, where we fortified ourselves with a dinner of pot pies and watery beer at the Koa Wood Bar of the Anchor Saloon. When the cheering started next door, he drained his glass and stood.
Hurry up and get your drinking done, or we'll miss the brawling.
The commissioner's saloon advertised boxing matches between sailors, only a nickel to watch. Kashmir elbowed me.
What do you think, Amira? If we fight, we get in free.
I dug out 10 pennies, but only after pretending to give it careful consideration. The next match was between a massive harpooner and a scrappy coalman. We placed our bets, Kashmir for the one and I for the other, and I looked to be winning until the coalman ducked a swing and the harpooner hit a crook in the crowd. Kashmir pulled me outside and we watched through the window as the ensuing brawl broke 2 tables, 5 chairs, and 6 noses. That's more than a nickel's worth, I said a bit breathless.
Only the best for you.
We found a more genteel atmosphere at the Royal Saloon, where the laughter spilling into the street was hearty but not raucous. We split another pint. The beer here was dark and strong, and sat at a tiny table in a dark corner, catching our breath and listening to a fat man tell a bawdy joke. He roared at his own punchline, and so did the cadre of men around him. The bartender delivered another beer. The big man drained the rest of his glass and made a sizable dent on the next, wiping the foam from his thick mustache on the sleeve of his jacket. It was a fine jacket, with gold braid and epaulets on the shoulder, above the thick black mourning band. An awful lot of epaulets. Suddenly thrilled, I grabbed Cash's wrist. Kashmir!
I know. They say he comes here almost every night.
We watched the last king of Hawaii drink with his people. The jokes and the beer kept flowing, and about an hour in, Kalakaua bought a round for the entire bar in honor of his cousin, the late Princess Pauahi. Under the merriment was something familiar, as he stared into his 4th empty glass, and my thrill faded like an old photo. He dies of it, I said under my breath. The addiction, I sighed. Do you know, most people think his last words were, "Tell my people I tried." But that was a novelist's invention.
What were they really?
I'm a very sick man. I pushed aside my own mug, no longer thirsty. We should get back to the ship. A shadow crossed our table. Kashmir sighed.
I wish you'd said that 10 minutes ago.
I looked up into a pair of angry, blackened eyes. The sailor looming over us wasn't tall, but he was broad. His shoulders were twice the width of my own, and they moved under his shirt like a python constricting. The man was a stranger to me, but apparently not to Kashmir.
Where's my money, darky?
I choked, but Kashmir barely raised an eyebrow.
Do I know you? You got rich off my match last night at Commissioner's. Oh, was that you? I didn't recognize you without blood all over your face.
The man ran his tongue over his split lip.
That was me,
he said, speaking with the deliberate precision of a drunkard.
You bet against me. I threw the match.
The sailor leaned heavily on the table with his fists, His knuckles were raw.
I get a cut. That's the deal. We never made a deal.
Just give him the money, Cash.
Your mulatto's talking sense.
He was nose to nose with Kashmir, and his breath was brandy fumes.
It's not his, Amira.
It's not worth a broken jaw, I said through my teeth.
No, but it was worth the dresses I spent it on earlier.
Cash placed his hands primly on the edge of the table.
Look, sir, I'm sure we can settle this like gentlemen.
Without changing his expression, Kashmir lifted our side of the table. The sailor went down, smacking his forehead against the wooden tabletop. He collapsed in a heap, covered in beer, and we leaped over him. Cash didn't tell me not to run this time. We had half a minute's lead before the sailor stumbled out of the bar and into the muddy street, screaming obscenities, blood pouring from his nose. Kashmir looked back over his shoulder and laughed.
Now I recognize you.
Another 30 seconds, and patrons came tearing out after the sailor, including two members of the Honolulu police force, hastily shoving their red caps onto their heads. Kashmir and I splashed down a crooked alley, cut through the yard behind a laundry, and finally hid down a basement stairwell across from the Royal Hawaiian Opera House. We pressed into the shadows against a thick wooden door, trying to hear footsteps over the sound of our pounding hearts. Something wet started wicking up my skirt, and I hoped it was only water. It had been quiet for a good 5 minutes before my shoulders started shaking.
Amira, are you laughing or crying?
Both? He wrapped his arm around me and pulled me close, my back against his chest.
Shh. Negera na bosh, Cher. Negera na bosh. Shh.
Whatever he said, I knew what he meant, and his tone was soothing. I took a deep, shuddering breath and wiped my nose on my sleeve.
I don't know how you stay so calm.
I did warn you, Amira,
he said, reaching into his pocket for a handkerchief.
But I've seen much worse.
I dabbed my eyes with a square of silk and tried to steady my voice.
I didn't realize how seriously you took your shore leave.
This was years ago, before I came to the ship. Our friend back there wasn't half as menacing as the Sofor, the street cleaners.
Street cleaners?
I refolded the handkerchief. It was monogrammed B.L. I traced the initials and wondered whose they were.
Not the type with brooms, then.
They swept you up like trash. If they caught you sleeping, you'd wake up in the refuse pits outside the city, with the dead dogs and the dung and all the other waste.
His chest rose and fell against my back.
We used to argue about it, what we would do if it happened to us. You could live a very long time down there. There was plenty to eat.
For a while, I had no words. In the silence, the incongruous sound of laughter floated from a nearby bar. That's horrifying.
There were many who praised the Shah,
he said softly.
Indeed, the city had never been cleaner.
He shrugged.
See, it could always be worse. For example, we could have been facing the winner of the fight.
The mirth stole back into his voice. But I couldn't let go of the images of the pits, the waste of it all. I shuddered. I'm glad you're with us now. He laughed a little, then rested his chin on my shoulder.
Me too, Amira, for many reasons.
His breath was warm on my neck, and I shivered again, but not from fear. For a moment, all I wanted in the world was to turn around. Like Lot's wife, like Eurydice, to see what was in his eyes. But before I could gather the courage, he gave me another squeeze and dropped his arms. I sighed with regret and with relief.
Let me take a look. Count to 60. If I don't swear and start running, you can come out.
And if you do swear and start running? He flashed me his teeth.
Then wait 10 seconds and start running in the opposite direction.
He didn't swear, and neither of us ran. We returned to the ship as dawn was breaking, and as we passed under a thick banyan tree, I learned that on land, the first sign of a new day is not sunlight, but birdsong. I climbed the gangplank with my eyes half closed, but I stopped dead at the top. The captain was sitting stooped on my hammock. Suddenly, I was wide awake. His hands were wrapped around a mug of his vile instant brew, and his eyes were so hollow as to seem blackened. They cut from me to Kashmir, then back, taking in my flushed face and my dirty dress.
"You smell like beer."
"And you look like hell." Something, a shrug or a laugh, I couldn't tell which, made the hammock swing.
"Where have you been?"
"Exploring paradise." Slate raised an eyebrow, and Kashmir drew himself up.
"We went to a pub for dinner, Captain." "And stayed for breakfast?"
Kashmir grinned easily.
"The food was good."
Slate tasted his coffee and made a face. Then he jerked his chin toward the hatch.
"Better get some rest."
But Kashmir hesitated. I shook my head just a fraction of an inch, and he left. Slate stared after him for a long time. At last he spoke.
"You and him?"
"What? No." I kept my voice casual, but he narrowed his eyes and searched my face.
"Best not to get too attached,"
he said finally, hunching his shoulders over his coffee and staring at the water. I rolled my eyes. "You're one to talk." He didn't rise to the bait. I shifted my weight on tired feet, but he only sat there, blowing air over his coffee. He always brewed it hot to make it bitter, but he never drank it till it was cold. "What do you want, Slate?" I said, my voice loud in the night air. He looked up at me suddenly, like he'd forgotten I was there.
"Tell me about the man who came yesterday."
"What do you want to know?"
"Everything."
"Didn't Bee tell you?"
"She didn't say much."
"Neither did he," I said. "But he knew." Slate didn't need to ask me what I meant. He stood and started pacing.
"So he could ask for anything. Literally anything."
"Maybe he's just an opium smuggler," I said, wanting it to be true. "Joss sent him after all." He stopped in his tracks, then swiveled on his heel.
"He said that?"
I bit my lip. "Not exactly. I met her yesterday."
"Where?"
"In her apothecary. Christ, what are you afraid of? She might expose me to opium?" I ran my fingers through my hair. They stuck in the tangles. Exasperated, I dropped my hands to my sides. "Don't meet with him, then. When he comes back, we'll send him away." Slate stared at me.
"You know I need that map, Nixie."
"You haven't even seen it. What if it's another dead-ender?"
"If it's good, I'll need it."
I just shook my head. It was starting to throb. "Can I go to sleep now?" He chewed his lower lip, staring at the lightening sky.
"Fine, but only a couple of hours. He'll be back soon."
"So?"
"So I need you at the meeting to figure out how to get him what he wants. Don't look at me like that, Nixie. You know I can't plan a route without you."
I crossed my arms. "If you want me there, teach me to navigate." A desperate smile faded.
"I'm serious."
"So am I."
"I'm not asking, Nixie."
"Good," I said, lightheaded with exhaustion and beer and this new feeling, rebellion. "Because I'm not either. That's the deal. Take it or leave it."
"I am your father,"
he said. I only laughed.
"I am your captain."
His shout echoed in the harbor. "So what are you going to do?" I jutted out my chin. Victory was within my grasp. "Keel haul me? Hang me from the yardarm? Leave me in the next port?"
"No."
Slate threw down the pewter mug. It bounced and tumbled to the bulwark. Coffee splashed across the deck. Somewhere on shore, a dog started barking.
No,
he said again, quietly this time, and the coldness in his voice froze the laugh in my throat.
Not you.
Who then?
I asked, but his eyes flickered to the hatch where Kashmir had just gone, and I gasped. He folded his arms and stared at me.
I warned you not to get too close.
No. It was barely a whisper. I don't even know if he heard.
I told you he might not be around forever.
You're disgusting. For a moment, I couldn't move, turned to stone by the ugliness of the implication. I pushed my way past. I couldn't get away from him fast enough, but he grabbed my arm.
Now you understand,
he said, his eyes bright.
The pain of losing someone you love.
My mouth twisted.
Oh, I've understood for a while, Captain,
I said, spitting the words out like broken teeth.
But you always come back when you want something. Maybe one day I'll lose you for good.
He released my arm, and for a moment neither of us moved. Finally, he dropped his eyes, ashamed, but not enough.
I'm going to try to catch some sleep,
he said, picking up the coffee mug.
I'll see you in a few hours.
For once, I went to my cabin. Wide awake, I dug out my map from my trunk and traced the lines of Carthage, the scoop of the bay, the wide main street leading up from the harbor, the market where I would make my fortune and buy my own ship, and cast off this anchor, dragging me down. Chapter 13. After my argument with Slate, there was no chance of sleep, and no chance I would miss the meeting. So by the time the sun was fully risen, I was waiting on deck for the man to arrive. I had even tidied up the captain's cabin, perhaps more forcefully than necessary. I'd had to work around Slate, and more than once I caught him watching me out of the corner of his eye, though neither of us dared speak. Around 10, the man called up from the pier, and I showed him aboard with a thin veneer of civility. He gave Slate a self-assured nod as he entered the captain's quarters and took the chair I offered. Then he smoothed the lapels of his frock coat.
Captain Slate, at last. And your daughter, is she Miss Slate or Miss Song?
Any pretense of cordiality fell away from Slate's face.
If you know her mother's name, I'm sure you know we never had the chance to marry. What do I call you?
The man's smile only widened. Perhaps he had noticed, as I had, that the captain had not asked his name.
You may call me Mr. D.
Slate wasted no more time.
Miss Song tells me you have a business proposition for us. Ah, yes.
Mr. D folded his hands neatly and waited. After a few moments of silence, he shifted slightly.
It is for your ears only. I never hide anything from her,
Slate lied.
Unusual, Mr. D said, although perhaps the unusual should not be unexpected, as it is vital to the gentleman I represent that everything be done in utmost confidence. Let me impress upon the both of you the importance of confidentiality, by showing what's at stake.
He took a thick square of paper from his breast pocket and unfolded it with excruciating slowness.
This is a copy of a map of Honolulu, showing the downtown area and the harbor. A copy? Slate said. I did not think it wise to take the original out into the world. What if I had been waylaid by brigands?
Mr. D was smiling, but I caught his meaning.
On it are marked several locations of note, he continued, including the more interesting,
His eyes flickered up to me, then back down.
The more interesting bars, brothels, and opium dens. It was inked in November of 1868. Let me see it.
And there it was, the energy of the strummed string, the coiling of the great cat before the spring. Slate remained in his chair, but barely.
Of course.
Mr. D laid the paper on the desk between them, smoothing it with a graceful motion. The captain stood, stooping over the desk, exploring the page.
It's not dated, he said immediately. I can assure you it's authentic.
Without lifting his head, Slate glanced up at him, letting his smile show.
The date can be inferred from the depiction of the city. You'll note that a popular place for tourists and locals alike had, very temporarily, a change of name. Joss's shop had become...
He placed one delicate finger down on a point on the map. Slate's eyes followed, and his breath caught in his throat.
Hop by, Holly. Apparently there was a woman working there, whose condition was quite the talk among the regulars.
By the look on Slate's face, Mr. D must have been talking about my mother.
You know how the locals are, always jabbering. Shortly after, tourists started calling it the Happy House, not knowing the meaning of the word hapai. It's quaint, but the natives are charming about such things.
I looked from Mr. D to Slate. I didn't know the meaning of hapai either. Slate pressed his fist to his mouth, as if kissing the tattoos on his knuckles.
It is suspiciously specific,
he said after a long pause.
Where did you acquire it? It belongs to one of my colleagues,
Mr. D said.
His brother was the artist. I'd like to speak with the brother. Tragically, he passed away years ago.
Oh?
Drowned in the bay. Drunk, I believe. The black sheep of his family. You may imagine, a man who would map the dens of vice would frequent them as well. I was the executor of his will, and it was in the performance of that duty that I noticed the map. And, of course, our mutual friend told me you would want the original. How fortuitous,
Slate said. Mr. D spread his hands and then clasped them.
Who can say what force throws us all together? But we are now bound by a mutual interest, which is what brings me here today. Yes.
Slate narrowed his eyes.
Your price.
He gazed at the map. The longing was plain on his face.
Name it.
Mr. D nodded, as though he had never expected any other answer.
It's quite reasonable, I assure you. My colleagues and I, in exchange for this map, all we want is, well, money.
The word turned Slate's head.
Money?
I frowned. I'd been worried after Mr. D's mention of unusual skills and extraordinary tales, but money? Money was, well, not easy, but maybe Slate already had enough at Bishop Bank. Perhaps my father's fears and his threats had been for nothing. The captain returned to his chair.
How much? I must remind you, this must be kept in complete confidence, or... Yeah, yes.
Slate took a deep breath.
We are already in agreement.
Mr. D laced his fingers.
For this map, my colleagues and I require $900,000.
My jaw dropped, and Slate raised one eyebrow.
900,000?
He said, his voice so steady even I could barely hear the shock.
That's a princely sum. Almost kingly,
Mr. D said with a smug look.
Obviously there won't be any deal without me seeing the real map first,
Slate said.
Certainly, sir,
Mr. D replied.
I wouldn't expect any different from you. 900,000.
Slate glanced at me, his expectation clear. It would be my job to gather Mr. D's ransom. I gritted my teeth, my mind racing. It was an outrageous amount. We'd have to stay on the island. We couldn't leave and come back, not without another map. Although, if we had another map, could we find another map we knew would work? One that would bring us to a time after we'd made the deal? It would have to be inked tomorrow or later. That was the real trick of it. But not too much later, or Mr. D might grow impatient.
"And how long before you expect payment?"
Slate said, but I was only half listening. Why did they want $900,000 in the first place? As Slate had said, it was a princely sum, especially for the era. That kind of money could change history.
"We aren't unreasonable. Say, before the year is out?" "Well," Slate said, "I despise haggling. Bring me the map, the original. If it's good, you'll have your money."
Mr. D lifted his hand, palm out.
One moment, Captain. Unfortunately, sir, it's not that simple." "And why not? Has the price gone higher in the last few moments? If the map is authentic, you can have a million."
I swallowed. Damn his pride.
"The price is unchanged, and the map is authentic. I am a very honest man,"
Mr. D smiled.
"The only quibble is, we want that money to come from a very specific place." "And where is that?"
the captain asked, biting into each word.
"From the vault at Ali'iolani Hali, the Royal Hawaiian Treasury."
I gasped audibly, but Mr. D didn't seem to notice. His eyes were locked on the captain's. I swallowed again as the words sunk in. Nearly $1 million from the treasury.
"Treason," Slate said at last. "You are not a subject, sir. It is merely piracy." "Merely," Slate repeated and laughed. "I wasn't talking about myself."
The genteel charm dropped from Mr. D's face.
"I have offended you," he said, his voice clipped. "I will remove myself from your presence."
And he plucked the map from the desk and crumpled it in his fist.
"No, no! Sit, please!"
the captain said, trying to soothe Mr. D, or perhaps to soothe himself.
"I'm not offended, just surprised. I'm not usually involved in politics."
"Ah." Mr. D settled back into the chair so readily, I suspected he hadn't intended to leave in the first place.
"Would that I could say the same. Unfortunately, circumstances have forced my hand. Politics are always complicated, sir. But even you can understand that Hawaii needs a strong leader. I would think the king would be weakened with an empty treasury,"
Slate said, his tone cautious.
"I said a strong leader, sir,"
Mr. D said, passing the ball of paper back and forth in his hands.
"Not a strong king."
I went cold. But Slate only stared for a moment, then nodded once.
"One thing I would like to know," he said. "What part does our mutual friend have in all this?"
Mr. D laughed.
"Ah, well, she is a businesswoman. All she wants is to be paid."
I raised a finger. "One more question, sir." Slate shook his head, but I pretended not to see it. "Why us?"
"Why? Well,"
Mr. D said with a small laugh,
"I was under the impression you'd want the map."
I dropped my hand to my lap. So it was not our strengths that brought him here, but our weaknesses. Who else would consider doing something like this for a scrap of paper? Slate rubbed his hands over his head.
"Before I give you an answer, I'll need to see it. The map, the real one."
"Very well."
"Meet me tomorrow?"
"Ah, tomorrow is Sunday. I will be at church." Slate stared at him.
"Of course you will." "An idea occurs to me," Mr. D said smoothly. "In a week's time, on the night of the full moon, the owner of the map, the artist's brother, is hosting a soiree at his home. Perhaps you'd like to attend? You can meet my colleagues face to face. You can assure yourself of the map's authenticity, and you can give us your answer.
Slate chewed his cheek.
Yeah, fine. That's fine.
I'll ensure an invitation is delivered tomorrow, and I'll send a carriage for you.
Mr. D stood.
I look forward to your attendance and your answer at the ball.
Slate, lost in thought, did not respond. As do we, I lied for him. For I had a sinking feeling. I already knew what the answer would be. Chapter 14. With Slate trailing behind us, I escorted Mr. D out of the room. Though the distance from cabin to gangplank wasn't more than 20 feet, I was protective of the ship. Slate had told me from a very young age not to talk to strangers about navigation. Obviously, he hadn't always followed his own advice. Once safely ashore, Mr. D paused for a moment at the edge of the dock, still holding the wadded copy of the map. The man made sure to meet Slate's eye before he smiled brightly and tossed the ball of paper into the sea. Then he gave us a nod and stepped into his coach. Slate watched the street long after the carriage was out of sight. "Captain," I said, and he startled. I took a breath, trying to sound firm. "The answer will be no, right?" Slate blinked, slowly, as if he'd been dreaming.
"I can't answer that until I see the map."
I stared at him. "We're not going to steal that money. We can't participate in this."
"We'll do what we have to."
Slate pushed off from the rail and walked toward his cabin.
"You may," I said, calling after him.
"Leave me out of this one."
He stopped in his tracks and then swiveled slowly on his heel.
"Did you forget our conversation last night? I told you, Nixie, I need your help."
I met his eyes dead on. "Not as much as you need Kashmir's." Slate stared at me, his face turning red, before going to his cabin and slamming the door. I slid down against the bulwark and stared up at the clouds, pulling the pearl of my necklace back and forth along the chain.
"What does he need my help for, Amira?"
Cash was peering at me over the lip of my hammock.
"What did the fine gentleman want?"
I sighed. "The contents of the treasury."
"A diamond."
His eyes were round as coins.
"What did the captain say?" "No, that's a silly question. Of course he said yes."
"Technically, he's still thinking about it," I said. "We're supposed to take a look at the map at some party next week."
"How much money is it?"
"In the treasury? $900,000. He whistled low.
"In all my life, I haven't stolen a tenth so much."
I looked sideways at him. "There's no reason to sound happy about it."
"I shouldn't take pride in my work?"
"Not when it's wrong."
"Robbing a king?"
He gave me a crooked smile.
"Even I've read Robin Hood."
"The treasury doesn't belong to the king. It belongs to the people."
"I've tried that one before. It didn't work. If you can get arrested for taking something, it's not yours."
"That's what I'm saying. It's wrong."
"It's illegal,"
he corrected.
"There are a lot of things that are illegal but not wrong, and probably more that are wrong and still legal."
"There has to be a line, Kashmir," I said angrily. "A person can't do just anything for love." He shrugged one shoulder.
"I would."
"Yeah, well, you're a thief. Your relative morality is already suspect."
"Ah,"
he said then, standing.
"Well, I'll leave the morality for those that like the taste of it. I always preferred bread."
"Kashmir, wait!" But he didn't. Instead, he slipped down through the hatch. I waited to hear him slam his cabin door, but he did not oblige. Left alone with my frustration, I went through my chores with a distracted energy, sweeping the deck, feeding the sky herring,
even filling the big copper vat with water and tossing in one of the fire salamanders, followed by my dirty laundry. After the water was good and hot, I plucked the little creature out with a pair of bamboo tongs. His flat-mouthed expression was one of mild offense. By the time I was hanging my clothes out to dry, I was calm enough to feel ashamed. Kashmir wasn't the one I was mad at. I hung my last shirt on the line and went downstairs to knock on his door.
Come.
I opened the door a crack and peeked in. He was lying there on his back in the pile of ratty silk pillows he used for a bed, reading. He didn't look up from his book. I cleared my throat. I'm sorry about calling you a thief.
Don't be,
he said quietly, turning a page delicately with his finger.
It's the truth, after all.
Only part of it, and not the most important part.
Well.
Then he put his book on his chest and smiled up at me, waggling his eyebrows.
What is the most important part?
I kicked a pillow at him. He caught it.
Save it for the next time we're at commissioner's, he said,
throwing it back at my head. I sprawled down on one of the bigger cushions, sending up a puff of air. Speaking of shore leave, there's a ball coming up, and I'll need a handsome date. But you'll have to do.
Only if I can wear my steel-toed shoes,
he arched one brow.
I've seen how you dance. So, you're going after all?
I frowned. I need to take a look at the map. If it's fake, the whole issue is moot. He propped himself up on one elbow. The book fell away from his hands, open on the pillows.
What if it's not?
I had no answer, so I picked up the book and closed it. It was well worn, with large print, the bright colors starting to fade. A version for children, like most of the books he owned. The Jungle Book?
One of my favorites. I used to feel like Mowgli.
Feral? I said pointedly. His face stayed serious.
The laws of the jungle remind me of the laws of the street. When I came aboard, I had to learn a different set of laws. Everywhere we go, there is a different set of laws, most of them unwritten.
I really am sorry about calling you.
It's all right, really. What I meant is, I wasn't at home right away.
He reached out to play with the tattered edge of one of the cushions. Kashmir, like me, had come to the ship with no belongings, but now the room was full of riches and reminders. The pillows were sewn from scraps of silk, and scattered around the room were wooden statues and stone bowls, and bone knives and strings of seeds, tiny treasures that could be slipped into a pocket. On the walls were pages torn from books. As I leaned closer, I saw they were poems. All I had collected were dust and costumes. I sighed. Do you feel at home now? He met my eyes.
You helped me to.
Oh, good, I said, nonplussed. I leaned back, gazing down at the book in my hands, trying desperately to think of something to say. You know, Kipling was a horrible racist. Oh, for God's sake. I threw the book aside. But it made him laugh. I was relieved.
Well, I stole the book, so he wasn't paid. Besides, that version was published in the 1960s. He was long dead by then.
He's out there now, though. He and Mr. D would get along.
This is the age of empire. There are a lot of people who share their views.
And a lot of people being ground down under their feet.
Maybe at the bottom of it. It's all just the law of the jungle.
He sat up and wrapped his arms around his knees.
While you were doing your laundry, Slate called me in to talk.
My breath hitched in my throat.
And? I'm sure you can imagine the general idea.
Why are you making that face? The captain has been good to me.
He didn't have to take me in, and he doesn't have to let me stay.
My cheeks went hot, and my skin felt too tight. You hurt him last night.
And I'm glad for the chance to earn my keep. I never learned to beg.
He shrugged.